Greetings and welcome to the Science Podcast for July 22nd, 2011. I'm Stuart Wills. This week, how to preserve coral reefs amid an uncertain future, deciphering the causes of a mass extinction 200 million years ago, and exploring parrot communication in a unique long-term experiment. All this plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Global warming and its effects in the sea have especially sobering implications for coral reefs. Some forecasters have suggested that a worldwide collapse of reef ecosystems may be in the offing in only a matter of decades. A review article published this week in Science notes that the current danger for coral reefs is indeed very great, but that the actual response of reefs to climate change is likely to vary a great deal in space, in time, and among different coral species. That variability, the authors suggest, opens up a window of opportunity for better management to delay and reduce the effects on reef environments of both climate change and local stressors. I spoke with the review's lead author, John Pandolfi, from his office in Brisbane, Australia. He pointed out that human insults on coral reefs are not a new thing.
I think one of the most important things that we found out over the last 10 years or so is that there's really few places that we can go, if any, that remain untouched from human impacts. So really, any reef you might like to visit has suffered from human degradation. And this degradation started from the first interactions with humans, long before the effects of climate change were being felt. And this degradation has really increased in rate and intensity over the past 50 years. So, again, many reefs are in a highly degraded state, even without considering any future effects from climate change.
So what are the main environmental threats facing reefs right now?
Well, we like to, in the coral reef community, to talk about the big three, and those are, firstly, over-exploitation, our incredible ability to overfish, to extract resources from the sea to a point where they no longer become sustainable. The second major threat, of course, is pollution, and this involves coastal development, changing land use practices that result in terrestrial runoff and high nutrients. In effect, we're reducing the water quality that the coral reefs are able to exist in. And of course, thirdly, is climate change. And the two double whammies are global warming, of course, and ocean acidification.
One of the points that you make in your review was that corals are living creatures, and so perhaps to some extent they can evolve their way out of some of this. But I guess there are limits to that?
Well, in some sense, evolution is the real wild card in all of this. On the one hand, I think it's wrong-headed to think that Darwin has taken a vacation just because the rate of climate change is so rapid. Similarly, though many corals do have long generation times, the large majority of them don't. They're able to reproduce after only 4 or 5 years, and often sooner. And they have symbionts, the photosynthetic dinoflagellates that are the engine of the coral growth. They have exceedingly short generation times. So there's a great potential for adaptation and acclimation that really hasn't entered the equation yet. Now, on the other hand, just because coral reef organisms respond to natural selection and potentially evolve doesn't mean that will save them either. For example, positive selection on one trait, say thermal tolerance, might be deleterious for a correlated trait, say calcification response to ocean acidification. But because we know next to nothing about these processes on coral reefs, it really is very difficult to speculate on what the effects evolution will have. And I think this is a real glaring hole in coral reef science right now.
Well, I wonder if the geological record can tell us anything. There have been climate and environmental changes in the geologic past. What does the rock record tell us?
Well, we do know that corals and reefs have had tremendous resilience to climate change over the geological past. No matter how hard and how many times they've been knocked down, they seem to generally be able to return. Now, that return is undoubtedly at far slower rates than the ecological and management time scales that most people are concerned with today. In addition, evidence from the geological past tells us that global warming and ocean acidification acting together have been responsible for a number of past reef crises. They've even played roles in mass extinction events. So we know that these threats, these climate change effects, are very important in the past demise of coral reefs. Now, what's different today is the rate of climate change. We're unable to identify any periods in Earth history where rates of CO2 rise are comparable to that of today. Now, this could in part stem from our inability to measure CO2 rise with a fine-scale temporal resolution that's available for us to measure it today. But so far, there's no real known mechanism where we could get such huge rises in the rate of CO2 in the geological past. We just don't know any mechanisms that would give us this comparable rate that we're seeing today. Now, again, on the other hand, there does seem to be some evidence that coral reefs can vary in their ability to cope with dramatic changes in climate. So, for example, about 55 million years ago, we had a major warming event in the Earth. It was called the Paleocene-Eocene Thermal Maximum. We got a dramatic spike in CO2. We had a dramatic warming event, so those two things were acting together. And what happened was, in coastal reefs, we had reefs that were dominated by corals that switched over to 4-AM-dominated reefs. Now, 4-AMs are little, almost microscopic, one-celled organisms with a calcareous skeleton that can be quite prolific and build reefs in and of themselves. But there was this big switch from a structuring coral-dominated ecosystem to a more flattened foraminifera-dominated ecosystem. But if we go offshore, there are other places where an oceanic reef continued with coral-dominated reef growth and seemingly unaffected by this spike in CO2 and warming. So the message here is that there really is spatial and temporal variability in reef response to climate change.
Looking at the whole picture that you lay out in your review, there seems to be an awful lot of contingency and complexity, a lot of if this, then that scenarios. Is there any way to get a general handle on what the future holds for coral reefs, given the trends that we're seeing today?
Well, Stuart, one of the issues we tried to stress in the review is that our ability to project what the future holds is really impaired by our lack of knowledge in certain key areas. And as I've already mentioned, one of the most important of these is the evolutionary potential of coral reef organisms. A lot of the current projections that we're hearing today tend to emphasize the worst-case data coming out of experimental and modeling studies. But we think that the response to coral reefs to climate change is going to be quite subtle and quite nuanced. There's going to be a lot of spatial variability, a lot of temporal variability, a lot of taxonomic variability in the way that different corals respond to climate change. So let me give you a couple examples. Within coral communities, there's a lot of variation among species about how susceptible they are to bleaching. Now, coral bleaching is when the coral symbionts are lost from the coral host, and the name comes from the fact that when that occurs, the coral turns white, and it often leads to mortality. But if we look at mass bleaching events, we find that in certain places bleach and certain other places don't. Certain species bleach and then certain species don't. Certain populations from one species might bleach in one area and might not bleach in another area. So there's a lot of variability there. Moreover, corals may flip from a less resistant symbiont strain to a more resistant symbiont strain in the aftermath of a bleaching event. And they might also switch back again. And it's these sort of dynamics, these symbiont dynamics, that may impart some measure of protection against vulnerability to climate change that we really need to investigate. Let me give you another example, and this gets back to the coral's ability to calcify under conditions of ocean acidification. The problem for corals or for any organism that precipitates calcium carbonate as a skeleton is that when CO2 rises, in the present day, aragonite saturation state falls. And aragonite saturation state is essentially a measure of the potential for organisms to secrete their skeletons. Now, it's been commonly assumed that corals will have a hard time secreting their skeletons when this aragonite saturation state falls below 3. But in our review, we've uncovered literature where coral reefs are thriving where saturation states fall well below 3. Even more astonishingly, there is an ability for corals to make their skeletons in seawater where aragonite saturation states fall below 1. That's the point at which abiotic carbonate begins to dissolve in the sea. Hmm. We go from a saturation state to a dissolution state. So it's very clear that the corals are able to mediate the seawater in which they precipitate calcium carbonate. We simply can't project that aragonite saturation states less than X, caused by CO2 levels higher than Y, will result in the demise of coral reefs by decade Z. We just can't do that. It's far more complex and variable than that. And I think our task is to try to understand this subtlety and then evaluate reefs on a more regional scale to understand how this demise of coral reefs is going to unfold. And it surely will, that demise or that degradation will surely be a feature of the coming seascape. There's no doubt about that. But I think the important point is that we need to identify the mechanisms at work to see if we can understand the variation spatially, temporally, and taxonomically.
Well, given all of that complexity, I guess I'd be interested in your views on what this means on a policy level in terms of actually managing and conserving reef resources.
Well, I think basically there's three things that we can do. Basically, we need to do anything that's going to slow the rate of climate change. Slowing the rate of climate change will diminish its impacts and maximize the potential for the reefs to recover and even adapt. So I think at the level of policy, the first thing we must really do is to act to slow that rate of climate change. That means aggressive CO2 emissions reductions. The second thing we can do is to reduce local stressors. Larger, well-connected populations generally have greater capacity to evolve, for example, than smaller, poorly connected populations. So when we look at human impacts like fishing, pollution, habitat destructions, these processes all fragment population and they decrease population sizes. So they reduce the potential of coral reefs to adapt to warmer, more acidic conditions. And the last thing is we just need the immediate expansion of sensible management strategies. You know, we're at a point right now that we've developed some very sophisticated management strategies, marine spatial planning, marine protected areas, controls over exploitation, increases in water quality. These are all very, very effective management strategies that can reduce the degradation in living coral reefs. And we feel that the very best we can do is to reduce those stressors, manage the reefs well, so that when climate change does act in a more aggressive way, that the reefs are in as good a shape as they can to handle that.
John Pandolfi, thanks very much.
Thank you, Stuart.
John Pandolfi is lead author of Projecting Coral Reef Futures Under Global Warming and Ocean Acidification, a review article in this week's Science. From the tribulations of corals amid modern climate change, we next wind the clock back 200 million years to another major climate event, a huge release of atmospheric carbon and subsequent rapid climate change that may have triggered the mass extinction that marked the end of the Triassic period. Previous research has linked this extinction to long-term volcanic outflows related to the breakup of the supercontinent Pangaea and the subsequent opening of the Atlantic Ocean. But a new study in Science, which zeroed in on the carbon isotope signature of land plants, has identified a massive and much more abrupt methane burp at the end of the Triassic, possibly intensified by positive climate feedback loops. The authors of the study believe that its results may be instructive as a deep-time analog of contemporary climate change. I spoke with the lead author, Misha Roux, from his office in the Netherlands.
Well, the aim of the study was mainly to better understand the relations between the massive release of carbon to the atmosphere and especially causal relations to changes in climate, and especially temperature, and extinctions of plant and animal species.
Okay, well, let's try to set the stage for this. This work in particular was about the mass extinction that took place at the end of the Triassic period, about 201 million years ago. Could you tell me a little bit about that event generally?
At the Triassic-Jurassic time interval, well, we have to remember that Earth looked very, very different than today. So all the continents were still connected in one big continent called Pangaea. In the end Triassic, this continent starts to break up, and it starts to form the Atlantic Ocean. And this is a very, very long process that continues for hundreds of millions of years and still continues today. And somewhere in the end Triassic, we also have a major volcanic event. And it's believed that this volcanic event is related to the onset of the breaking up of this major continent, Pangaea. And at the same time, at the onset of this volcanic event that we know of, there was a major extinction event in the oceans. So we know that about 50% of all species, animal species that lived in the oceans went extinct. But also on the continents, there were big changes in vegetation.
And I guess that extinction has previously been ascribed to this massive volcanic outflow that you touched on.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so we know from previous studies that the onset of the volcanic event coincides with the mass extinction event. So the extinction event is only very briefly, it takes about 40,000 years, but then the volcanic event takes much longer.
So was that difference in timing, the difference between the very brief, geologically sudden mass extinction and this much longer volcanic outflow, was that sort of the puzzle to be solved here?
That's right. So there were two major questions, actually. So one is the volcanism the main trigger for changes in climate that were going on and the extinctions that we observed in the oceans? And the second question was, what is causing the extinctions, basically? So is it only the volcanism, or have there been other processes involved?
And I guess from looking at your paper, you used carbon isotopes to study this, as people have done before, but you took a very much more sort of refined look at them. Could you tell me something about the approach you used?
So normally people study changes in the carbon cycle to study the release of carbon to the atmosphere. And what people normally do, they measure the changes in the ratio between two different types of carbon. So people collect rocks, and they study the ratio between these different types of carbon isotopes in those rocks. The problem is, however, that there are many processes influencing this ratio between these two isotopes. And now what we did is we looked much more in detail. Well, we studied the change between these isotopes in plant leaves. So we extracted molecules from the rocks, and these molecules are produced by these plants. And these plants take up the carbon from the atmosphere. So if we look only at the molecules, so not at all kinds of forces, but only at change of the isotope ratio in these molecules, then we could potentially see how the ratio in these between these isotopes changes in the atmosphere.
So in some sense, by focusing on one type of carbon and one type of molecule, this could kind of screen out a lot of the sort of extraneous factors that might contribute to the carbon signal?
That's right.
Okay. Well, what did this approach tell you that you didn't know before about this event?
Yeah, so one of the things that we found, that people previously thought that the amount of carbon being released was relatively small. And also, so the change between these different isotopes was also relatively small. We now see that the change in the ratio between these isotopes in the atmosphere is much, much bigger. So that suggests that there was much more carbon released than people previously thought. And I guess that's one of the major findings. Then the second finding is that it's likely that it's not only the volcanism where the carbon is coming from, but that there's another process which releases much more carbon than only the volcanism.
So, yeah, that was very interesting to me because, as you noted, people have kind of tied this mass extinction to this huge eruption event associated with the breakup of Pangaea.
Yeah.
But your work seems to suggest that either this wasn't the triggering event or the story was a lot more complicated. What sort of models are you thinking about?
Yeah, that's right. So people previously thought that this whole event was only related to the volcanism. But what we now know is that the volcanism took about 600,000 to maybe a million years. And we know that this mass extinction event was only maybe 40,000 years, so that was much shorter. So that made us think that maybe the volcanism couldn't be the only trigger for this event. What we now observe, what the data suggests, is that the volcanism triggered a carbon dioxide release from volcanism, and that triggered an initial increase of temperature. And this initial increase of temperature then triggered the massive release of methane from the seafloor. And methane also consists of carbon. So this caused that a lot of carbon was released to the atmosphere. So likely the volcanism triggered the release of methane, and then the methane was the major contributor of carbon to the atmosphere.
So in a sense, what you think you might have been seeing here is one of these positive feedbacks that people talk about in thinking about today's greenhouse warming. Essentially,
yes.
a small increase in temperature hits a part of the system that is sensitive to that, and then there's a positive feedback effect.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm interested because at the end of the work, you do sort of suggest that this situation is an analog to today's greenhouse warming. And I guess I was wondering if you could just touch a bit more on that, because clearly we're talking about very different sorts of processes here. Could you just talk a little bit more about how you see a parallel between those two situations?
Yeah, of course, we have to be very careful in comparing the current day situation with time intervals, which are hundreds of millions of years ago, especially as I already told, that the Earth looks very differently, and there were possibly also different processes working in those time intervals. But the interesting thing to learn from these kind of studies, I think, is that just a small release of carbon seems to set in motion these positive feedbacks that you already talked about, and then release a lot of carbon. So this positive feedback that may now not have started yet, but could potentially start, massively influence the current release of carbon to the atmosphere.
Misha Ruh, thanks very much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Misha Ruh is the lead author of a new study on the end Triassic mass extinction and its causes. In a News Focus article this week, Virginia Morell reports on a long-term study in Venezuela that's plumbing the mysteries of parrot talk in the wild. Here's Virginia Morell.
A couple of years ago, I was at Cornell University to meet with elephant researchers who are studying elephant vocalizations. And Cornell, you know, they collect natural sounds around the world from various species of all sorts, and especially birds. That's what they're famous for. And at the time, Jack Bradbury, behavioral ecologist there, was in charge of the lab, and someone introduced me to him, and we began talking. I told him what I was working on, which is a book about how animals think. And Jack said, oh, well, you really must include parrots. I said, well, I had Alex, the famous African gray parrot, and he said, well, more than Alex, you really must look at what parrots are doing in the wild, because Alex was raised with humans, and so it's different. And he said he had a student who was working at this wonderful study site in Venezuela where they'd been studying parrots in the wild for 24 years. And that immediately got my attention because I'd never heard of it. I said, why isn't this known? And he said, well, people in ornithological circles and ecology circles know about it because it's a very famous study site, Atomasa Gural. It's a cattle ranch. And so the project was started by Steve Bisinger, ecologist at Berkeley.
I gather from your article that this study, which, as you say, is the longest-running study of wild parrots, that it got started almost by accident.
Yes. Steve Bisinger had gone there actually to study raptors. He was working on snail kites. And from an ecological perspective, he had some particular questions that he wanted to ask about them. And while he was there, I went to the site. I was invited by Carl Berg to go there a couple of years ago, and so I saw all of these things. And the ranch is just full of bird life. It's just fabulous. And one of the things that Steve Bisinger noticed was that these little parrotlets, these small green parrots, were nesting in some of the fence posts on the ranch, where there was a hollow in the fence post. And he said it was amazing because rather than being high overhead in the canopy where usually parrots nest, you could just walk right up to this fence post, right at basically 3 or 4 feet off the ground, and there were the little birds nesting and doing all the things parrots do. So it occurred to him, what if I put up artificial nesting boxes as we do with bluebirds? Would they nest in them? And it took him a couple of seasons to figure out exactly what the birds would like, and he eventually came up with this design and put out a nesting box in 1987. A few weeks later, a pair of parrotlets moved in. Then over the next 2 seasons, he added more. So he had 40 initially, and then over the years, they have now a whole array of them, 106. They're spaced, a few meters apart along the fence line, and the parrotlets just flock to them. They have them actually in two different ecological settings because his initial questions are all about what are the birds doing and living in this particular habitat. So some are out more in pastures and some are more forested area covered with a lot of vegetation, and those particular boxes are not popular because inevitably either the mother is killed by a snake or the eggs are eaten by snakes. So those are not sought after.
So what are some of the other things that make this a particularly special study?
To begin with, parrots in the wild just have not been studied. And the reason for that is first that they live high in the canopy, and so the access to them is really difficult. And then once you find a nest, you're not going to have a number of nests. Jack Bradbury actually said he had sort of one nest of these larger parrots he was studying in Costa Rica to look at. So you don't have the sample size to really understand what the birds are doing. Then usually with New World parrots, it's rather difficult to tell the sexes apart, but these little parrotlets, they have markings that are slightly different between the male and the female. You can actually see the males have a little bit more yellow on their foreheads, and they have these blue patches that they use to advertise that they're the best guy to be a mate. So you have that easy accessibility is probably the key thing. They overcome all of these practical logistical problems that you usually have when you're trying to do a study of parrots.
So in a sense, they've got sort of both a wild study and a captivity study rolled into one.
Essentially, but it is all wild. These birds are absolutely wild. They do move into the nesting boxes, and the nesting boxes, Bisinger designed them in such a way so that you can take off the top and the bottom, and the birds do not leave when this is done. So you have absolute access. They can go in, and once they start laying eggs, they just take the eggs out and they mark each one. So they know individuals from the moment that they are laid as eggs, and then they can follow all of the events that take place to those marked individuals. Once they hatch, then they get a little plastic band at a particular age, and everything known about those is as individuals, and they have records going back, I think, now for over 8,000 known individual birds. So, yeah, it's a remarkable amount of data.
Well, a lot of the focus, at least in your article, is how researchers are using this site to study parrot communication. And I guess everyone knows that parrots can mimic human speech, but what do they say to each other in the wild?
This has always been the big question, because why do they imitate us? Obviously, they're not doing that in the wild. One study suggested that maybe parrots were imitating ambient sounds, and it had to do with developing a larger repertoire for the males to impress females. But that doesn't seem to really hold up. What they really do, and Jack Bradbury and other people have shown this, is that they imitate each other's calls. And it's very much like me saying your name, Stuart. You have a name, and I can imitate it, no problem at all. And it's a way that we have of getting one another's attention, and it's so hard to imagine how our society would function if you couldn't call someone by their name.
Mm-hmm.
And so in parrot society, it seems to be very much the same kind of thing, where each individual bird has a unique, what they call a contact call or signature contact call. And they are saying each other's names. They can say their name, and then they can say someone else's name. And perhaps they can even add additional information to it. That's an open question. But at this point, what they wanted to know is, how do they get these contact calls? And there was one captive study that suggested that some of the family members might be giving those to the little nestlings. But why would they do that? Why would this sort of system evolve? And so that's what Carl Berg set out to look at in his study, was it true that the parrotlets are getting some sort of a name more or less from their parents? Were they learning the calls in the wild? And at what age, and what would be the reason for that?
It's one thing to listen to the bird calls, but I imagine there must be a lot of subtlety here. How are they actually analyzing them?
The big difference between a parrot call and a bird song is that these are not songs. These are little sounds that they make. And it sounds to our ear like a peep, just a real short little peep. We can't hear the information that is in that peep because our ears just don't hear fast enough. And so they make recordings, so they take them back to the lab, they convert it into a spectrogram, which is like a visual picture of the sound. A little peep actually looks kind of like a Japanese calligraphy mark. It kind of has a little tail to it and then rises up. And within that peep, if you stretch it out, play it slowly, one can't even begin to imitate it, but it sounds something like, and it has this inflection at the end. It's a very odd thing.
Probably different from bird to bird, I would imagine.
Well, it is different from bird to bird, but they all have a little bit of an inflection at the end. And it's just like, you know, my name, Virginia Morell. So in my family, people have the last name Morell. The first name changes. Well, something like that is going on within little parrotlet families, because all of their signature calls have something similar to them, but they vary. And what Carl's study showed was that the parents are providing, if not the actual name, at least they're providing them with some template, as he called it, some kind of a model that they learn at about age 3 to 4 weeks, and then they modify it somehow and make it their own name. And a clutch may have anywhere from, just a couple individuals to up to 14. And they're hatching asynchronously. It's over a space of several days. So as the chicks grow, some of them fledge earlier than those who are still in the nest. And the parents have to find the little guys who fly out and are living in a roost with other fledglings from other nests. They have to find those chicks because they still need to be fed for another 3 weeks. So how are you going to find your little chicks, your own babies, who are out there in the wild world, unless you have some way to identify them? And that's what the contact calls serve. The parents can come in and say, I'm Mom, and where are you, Baby Joe? And Baby Joe can call back and say, I'm over here, Mom. Feed me.
Well, going from chicks to another species, I gather from your story that some of these scientists think that this might be able to tell us something about how human infants acquire speech?
Well, that's another area that people really debate, which is what are the first things that infants start learning, and one thing is their name. And how this is actually done is the source of a lot of debate. So if you had a species which is doing it in a way similar to the way that our human infants do it, it provides you with a model to perhaps look at and analyze and see, well, what exactly takes place in the parrots? Is it similar to what takes place in humans? And if you have models like that from two widely divergent species, it just gives you a better way to look at the question and to ask, well, what are the pressures and why and how does this develop and what are the genes involved? You know, is there an overlay here? We know there's some similarities already between bird song, for instance, and human speech. So then if you have a species that perhaps is even more similar, such as parrots, because in parrots both the males and females are doing this, and also these little parrotlets, like many parrots, are what we call lifelong vocal learners, as we are. Maybe the parallels are more similar than even with songbirds.
Virginia Morell, thanks very much.
Thank you, Stuart. It was very fun.
Virginia Morell writes about Otto Mazaguaral Ranch and what it's teaching us about parrot communication in a News Focus this week. Finally today, David Grimm, the online news editor of Science, is here to bring us up to date on some recent stories from our daily news site. First, Dave, something about the very slow cooling of the Earth over the last 4.5 billion years.
That's right, Stuart. You might be hard to imagine or think about it, but despite the fact that Earth is about 4.5 billion years old, it is still cooling off. And as you may know, Stuart, the Earth formed in a very hot event. It coalesced from this hot ball of gas, dust, and other materials. Very early in Earth's history, it was very much a molten, hot world. But despite the fact that it's been cooling off for so long, for billions and billions of years, it still has about half of its original heat, according to this new study.
And how did they figure that out?
Well, the study was conducted deep inside a Japanese mountain, and apparently you have to go way down deep to measure what's called the radiogenic heat produced by Earth. So there's two main types of heat that Earth produces. First, that original primordial heat from its formation, but there's also this radiogenic heat, which is basically the heat produced when isotopes decay. And this is a lot of heat too, but it's not heat directly linked to the formation of the planet. And this natural radioactivity produces neutrinos as a byproduct. And by going deep into the Earth, the researchers were able to try to eliminate a lot of the background sources of neutrinos, like nuclear power plants and other emitters of neutrinos. Basically, by doing all this, they found that about 111 of the neutrinos they measured were associated with natural radioactivity within Earth. And by doing a bunch of other calculations, they basically came to the conclusion that all of the natural radioactivity on Earth generates about 20 terawatts of heat. And what that adds up to is about 54% of the heat that's flowing through your surface comes from this radioactive decay, which means 46%, the leftover, is this original heat. So that means just about half, a little under half, of the heat that Earth produces is still left over from all of these formation events that happened billions and billions of years ago.
Isn't this something that was already known, though? This is sounding awfully familiar.
It actually was known before, but the studies that had been done before were really based on inferences. Researchers had done analysis of meteorites and other sort of more secondary sources to get at this figure. This is really the first direct measurement of this background radiation. And what's really interesting about it, just besides knowing that, hey, Earth still has a lot of heat left in it, is a lot of this internal heat is actually what guides the plate tectonics, the volcanic activity of our planet. So by studying how fast Earth loses heat, scientists can study a lot of geological processes in the past and even extrapolate into the future. And finally, if you're wondering when Earth may eventually totally become cold.
It was at the top of my mind.
The researchers say that according to their calculations, the planet is cooling about 100 degrees every 1 billion years. Now, that may not sound like a lot, but if you calculate forward a bit, it means that in a few billion years from now, Earth will essentially be a cold, dead planet. So
something to look forward to.
To look forward to.
And next, a tale of intrigue in the elephant seal harem.
Right, Stuart, this next story is all about the Beachmaster system in elephant seals. And basically what this system is elephant seal males, especially the dominant males, they're these really big hulking guys, and they are very territorial, very aggressive, very defensive, and they have these giant harems of females on a beach, sometimes hundreds of females that they look over, and they jealously guard these females. So if any other male comes on the beach, they fight them. The battles can be very bloody. And biologists have often pointed to this as a classic example of what's called polygyny in the animal kingdom. And that basically means one male mating with lots and lots of other females, and all those females only mate with that one male. Well, according to this new study, this system may not be as polygynous as researchers had suspected.
Not as polygynous, meaning that the females are indulging in a little hanky-panky here?
Exactly. The females are indulging in a little extracurricular hanky-panky. The way the researchers found out about this is they actually tagged a group of females, and what they found was that although the females tend to spend a lot of their lives at the beach, they're actually spending a lot of time also in the open water. They usually come back to the beach about once a year, ostensibly to give birth and also to mate with this dominant male. But a lot of times when they show up pregnant, which means that they've been...
Which surprises the Beachmaster.
Exactly. And it means that the females are having sex with the non-dominant males that are out in the open ocean or out elsewhere. And it really sort of challenges this idea that these females are sort of loyal to this one male. The reason some scientists thought this originally is they sort of went into this with a very male-biased approach to the research, the idea that, well, of course, a man is going to have total control over females and is going to be able to sort of dictate their every moves. And they would have said, well, the females get something out of it too, because even though they only get a mate with one male, that male is sort of providing them protection, and it's sort of a system that works out for everybody. But in this new idea, the fact that a lot of these females are going out and having these quote-unquote extramarital affairs means that the females actually have a lot more choice than the scientists have been giving them credit for. And yes, they may get some protection from this male, and that may be why they come back to this beach year after year to be with him. But by going out in the open ocean, they can exert a lot more choice in terms of who they mate with. And so they're sort of getting the best of both worlds. They're getting the protection, but they're also getting a lot more mate choice than scientists had previously believed.
And finally, this one really seems wild. A cloaking device not for hiding an object in space, but for hiding an event in time.
Right. Well, imagine this scenario, Stuart. A robber breaks into a bank, steals all the money from the safe, then returns home and activates a device that basically masks his entire foray into the bank. So that as far as the people in the bank know, the money just magically disappeared. The robber was never there, but all of a sudden the money is gone.
Sounds like it would help the elephant seal.
Could, very much could. This idea is called a time cloak. The idea that you could, as you said, Stuart, take a moment in time rather than an object and make it disappear. Now, the scenario I just described is a long way from reality, but researchers have actually made an important first step into turning such a time cloak into reality. And the experiment they set up involves a laser beam. And the basic idea, what they were trying to do with this laser beam is to create a gap in the beam so they would see that gap in the beam, but then find a way to retroactively make that gap disappear so that any other observer looking at the beam would just sort of see the continuous laser beam as if there had been no gap.
Well, how do you open a gap in a beam of light like that?
Well, the researchers created what they call a time lens, which is basically a device that can shift the frequency of the light. And basically, at a particular moment, they shift the frequency of the light higher and then suddenly lower. This is the frequency of the light in the laser beam. Then they send this, quote-unquote, frequency-modulated light through an optical fiber that's designed so that some of the wavelengths of light are sped up and travel faster than other wavelengths. And as one of these sets of wavelengths races ahead of the other set, a gap opens up between the beams. So that's how you get your gap. Now here's how you get your cloaking. After light is passed through the spot where the hidden event will occur, where they want to sort of mask this gap in the beam, the experimenters reverse the process. They run the light through a fiber in which the wavelengths have been sped up and slowed down, and those that have been slowed down are sped up, so the gap essentially closes. Now, this all sounds very complicated, but the essential effect is to retroactively erase that gap in the beam. So again, an observer that was looking at that beam would just see a continuous beam, whereas the researchers know that they had created a gap and then made it disappear.
So how long of a gap are we actually talking about?
Well, here? We're not talking about a very long gap here. In fact, they hit an event that lasted 15 trillionths of a second, not nearly long enough to rob a bank. So we're a long way from the next Ocean's 11 movie where a bank robber employs this type of technology. But again, it is an important proof of concept. It's an important first step. The researchers think that as they keep on working on this, they may be able to eventually hide an event that lasts up to 110 billionths of a second. Mm-hmm. So
that's progress.
Still very much the blink of an eye, but definitely getting farther along. And of course, as this is developed down the line, perhaps you could eventually get a device that could mask an event that takes place over a much longer span of time, robbing a bank or perhaps erasing an embarrassing faux pas earlier in the day. You're going to have to wait a while for that to happen, but researchers are on their way.
They're on the trail.
Nice
to know they're working on the important things. Okay, Dave, what else are you looking into for the news site this week?
Well, Stuart, for Science Now, we've got a story about what it may have been like for medieval knights to battle with armor. Researchers actually put a man in a suit of armor and made him run on a treadmill to see how much energy it actually takes to walk around with a suit of armor. So that's a fun story we're doing. Also, another fun story about rock, paper, scissors and the psychology behind this child's game. On Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got a story about the new Indian science minister and the impact that person may have on science in the country. Also, a story about plutonium production, what's going on with that in the U.S. and what the impact of that is on various scientific experiments. And finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's Science Alive is about the science of mummies. What are mummies telling us about diseases in the past and how those diseases are affecting us right now and also in the future? So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news and the policy blog Science Insider at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. And that wraps up the July 22nd, 2011 edition of the Science Podcast. Thanks to Carrie Klein for her help with this week's show. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Stuart Wills. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.